From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project.
Overlooking historic Bryant Park in Midtown Manhattan, live from NPR Studios, this is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. News, information, USA, USA. I'm Mike Pesca. It's Friday, July 4th, 2008. Happy birthday, America. America was born today. It was a breech birth, and it came out kicking. The country was nursed upon the teat of liberty as it suckled upon the sweet nectar of freedom. As it grew up, it was swaddled in the pamper of economic prosperity because it would often poop out discontent and populist unrest. Soon enough, young America enrolled in the Montessori School of Justice and enjoyed the juice of equality from the sippy cup of beneficence before enjoying the nap time of waving wheat fields and fertile valleys. But lo, it was awakened by the call of flowing rivers, and unfortunately, it couldn't get to the potty of environmental stewardship, so it had to wear the borrowed pants of civic disquiet. In its teenage years, America too often wanted to borrow the Oldsmobile of expansionism and play the Xbox of manifest destiny, but that, my friends, is a story for another time. For today on the BPP, we celebrate America's birth and its greatness. I have a picture of George Washington sitting in a hospital bed without makeup, looking like hell. But I am sure, I am ensured that mom and baby are doing well. I don't know who the mother of the country would be, so I went with George Washington. It is our July 4th extravaganza show. We will revisit a couple of patriotic interviews the BPP has done in years past. The entire enterprise is patriotic, informing the public. We'll kick it off with a conversation with the late Jordan Wright. He had one of the largest collections of campaign memorabilia in the world. Then to a true American patriot, Liz Phair. Liz was an idol to frustrated rockers, a hero to fed-up feminist women, and one of the most pleasant conversations we ever had. What is more American than that? It's the 15th anniversary of Exile in Guyville. And George Washington gets all the credit, like I just gave him during this, the 4th of July holiday. What about John Adams, America's first vice president, the man who is credited with helping keep the Union together during the Revolutionary War? We'll give it up to the J to the A later in the show. We'll have today's headlines in just a minute, but first.
Send in the clouds.
A little song, a little dance, a little seltzer down your face.
It is hard to say goodbye to a clown. Longtime Bozo the Clown Larry Harmon died yesterday of heart failure. He was 83. Harmon didn't invent the Bozo character, but he's credited with making the clown into a global business. The character was first created in 1946 for Children's Records and first voiced by Pinto Colvig, better known as the voice of Goofy. Harmon got a job playing the clown at local appearances to promote the records, and in the early 1950s, he bought the rights to the character. Harmon then added the signature elements of the Bozo look, the orange hair, the red nose, the red, white, and blue costume. Before the days of TV syndication, Harmon trained more than 200 clowns to play Bozo at local stations across the country. The most famous of them was a young Willard Scott.
They picked me to be Bozo. I went to clown school in California, and I was either going to be a politician when I graduated or Bozo. And I chose the straight life. I chose Bozo. See, I can still do it. That's the Bozo laugh.
Harmon licensed the character as well. Nearly every country in the world has a Bozo cartoon.
Bozo, il est temps de te réveiller.
The influence of Bozo on the clowns of today is clear. Without Bozo, there would be no Krusty. And when you think about the term Bozo, it's become synonymous with clownish behavior. Back in 1996, Harmon said he is proud of his legacy.
Anybody can do anything for 50 years has to be pretty successful. So Bozo is the longest-running children family show in the world and has created a positive influence for the families around the world for the last 50 years.
Larry Harmon is survived by his wife Susan, a son, and four daughters.
Send in the clowns. Those daffy, laffy clowns. Send in those...
Now, let's get some more of today's headlines with the BPP's Mark Garrison.
Hope you're enjoying your breakfast this holiday morning. If it happens to be pancakes, give a thought to Bill Gates. Today he's settling into life after Microsoft, but in his life before Microsoft took off, a much younger Bill Gates spent some time thinking about pancakes, an untidy stack of pancakes. He even published a mathematics paper about it. And academics say it was a fine piece of work. NPR's David Kestenbaum reports from the Lincoln Waffle Shop in Washington, D.C.
I need a stack of pancakes.
Okay. Would you like butter?
Sure. I need a big stack of pancakes.
Sure, thank you. I got you.
All right, so the problem Bill Gates was trying to solve was this. Imagine you work at a diner, and the cook is really fast, but he's not the most organized guy, and when he piles up the pancakes, sometimes the biggest pancake is on top and the smallest one's in the middle, and it's just a mess. So your job is to sort them using a spatula. You can only put the spatula in someplace in the stack and just flip the pancakes above you. You have to figure out a series of flips that will sort the stack so that you get the biggest pancake on the bottom, the second biggest one above that, all the way up to the smallest one on top so that you can present it to the customer in a nice pile. It turns out to be a very difficult math problem.
The question is, if there are n pancakes, where n is 73 pancakes or 12 pancakes or whatever, what's the minimum number of flips that suffice always to sort the stack?
Harry Lewis is a professor at Harvard University, and back in the 1970s, he gave this puzzle to his combinatorial mathematics class, just as an example of a problem that was easy to describe but had not been solved.
So I posed it in class, and then I went on, and a day or two later, as I recall, this smart sophomore comes into my office and explains that he's got a five-thirds N algorithm.
The student with the five-thirds N algorithm was Bill Gates. So what does five-thirds N mean? Well, there's a fairly simple way to sort the stack, but it would require two flips per pancake, 2N. Basically, you start by sticking the spatula under the biggest pancake, flip it and the stack above it, which puts the biggest one on top. Then you flip the whole stack, putting the biggest pancake where you want it, on the bottom. Then you repeat this for the second largest one, etc. Anyway, Gates had a better procedure. Instead of requiring two flips per pancake in the stack, it required five-thirds, or 1.67 flips.
And it involved a complicated case analysis of what exactly the configuration of the top few pancakes might look like and so on. It was quite clever.
Bill Gates worked on it with a young assistant professor at Harvard, and in 1979, the research got published under the title Bounds for Sorting by Prefix Reversal.
I think the problem remained pretty much in that state for 30 years, and then just recently,
some researchers found a slightly better sorting strategy, but it's only 1% faster, and they figured it out only with the help of powerful computers.
I have to look at this paper and laugh. You know, they never could have actually done the case analysis were it not for the computer industry that Bill Gates built in the intervening 30 years.
Lewis looks back on this story with pleasure. It was a brush with a kid who would shape history, even if it wasn't in the lofty realm of mathematics.
We, who've spent our careers in academia and consider this the highest calling known to humankind, will say, you know, that this really proves that Bill could have done something important and noble with his life. That's a joke. I do believe that he's done something enormously important and increasingly noble. But yes, you know, if he'd wanted to, he could have been a mathematician. Thank goodness he didn't choose that path.
Lewis won't say what grade Bill Gates got in his class, but he says Gates did well. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
Ari?
Uh-huh.
Did that rotten apple really hurt?
No, just a little bit messy is all.
Well, okay, so we've survived the stale gingerbread and rotten apples that hurled our way as yesterday we questioned whether William Shakespeare from Stratford-upon-Avon could have written the works that bear his name. Seriously, a lot of scholars say it doesn't matter who the author is, but a major theme in Shakespeare's work is the question of identity and disguise.
So many of the plays hinge around someone believing that someone else is a friend when they're a foe, or a foe when they're a friend.
Actor Mark Rylance has played virtually every major role in Shakespeare.
Someone having an image of themselves which doesn't actually turn out to be who they are. Someone thinking that a young man is a young man and they're actually a young woman, or vice versa, in the Shakespeare plays. That it's very attractive to think that the author would also weave that kind of magic around his or her identity.
Rylance is among those who think it likely the author did disguise his true identity behind the name William Shakespeare. As the founding creative director of London's Globe Theatre, Mark Rylance collected and displayed material about other contenders. This morning, we hear the case for one man who many think is the real author. We begin in the courtyard of the Globe.
Edward de Vere was the 17th Earl of Oxford, and he was a great star at court in his early years.
Charles Beauclerc is a direct descendant of Edward de Vere, the Earl of Oxford. He recounts the many reasons his ancestor de Vere could have written the plays. A Cambridge education, fluency in French, Italian, Latin, and Greek, a broad knowledge of the law, jousting and other royal pastimes, an intimacy with the Queen's court, a reputation as a poet, plus...
He inherited an acting company from his father, and throughout his life he always had at least one company, sometimes two. So the theatre was part of his life. He put on masks and plays at court.
Others during Queen Elizabeth's time had a similar resume. Oxford has been a favorite for more than 80 years because his own life intersects with the plays in a myriad of dramatic ways.
Take a map of Italy and take out 10 pushpins, and you put these pushpins in the following 10 cities: Venice, Padua, Milan, Genoa, Palermo, Florence, Siena, Naples, Verona, and Messina. That's essentially Shakespeare's Italy, right there.
And Shakespeare's Italy, argues author Mark Anderson, is Edward de Vere's Italy. In his biography of Oxford, titled Shakespeare by Another Name, Mark Anderson portrays a real life through which shines the many fictional lives in Shakespeare. Starting with Italy, from Romeo and Juliet's Verona to The Merchant of Venice, half of Shakespeare's comedies and tragedies are set in Italy. It's a place William Shakespeare never went, and where Edward de Vere traveled extensively.
Venice in particular is portrayed in The Merchant of Venice and Othello with such exquisite detail that could only come from someone who knows that city from firsthand experience. I mean, it goes from everything from ritualistic cultural curios. There's a character in Merchant of Venice who presents this dish of baked doves, and you see a production of Merchant of Venice, and people don't know what to do with it because it's just bizarre. Well, it turns out that in Venice at that time, a dish of baked doves was actually an honorific gift that you gave to someone as a token of your respect.
Another example can be found in The Taming of the Shrew. Daniel Wright directs the Authorship Research Center at Oregon's Concordia University.
We know that when Edward de Vere was in Venice, he borrowed 500 crowns from a man named Baptista Negroni. And when Oxford was in Padua, he borrowed more money from a man named Pasquino Spinola. Now, in Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew, Kate's father is described as a man who is rich in crowns. Where does this character in Shakespeare's play live? In Padua. And what is his name? Baptista Minola, a conflation of Baptista Negroni and Pasquino Spinola.
But for author Mark Anderson, the single most compelling play linking Oxford to Shakespeare's work contains this famous line.
The play is the thing wherein I'll catch the conscience of the king.
Here, Kenneth Branagh plays Hamlet, the Prince of Denmark. Turns out Edward de Vere's brother-in-law was an emissary to Denmark, and he wrote de Vere private letters about his experiences.
And he talks about these drinking rituals of downing a shot and then shooting off the cannons, and that, of course, is preserved in Hamlet. De Vere's brother-in-law writes about this banquet that he attends with these courtiers named Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. And again, all this stuff, it's unpublished. It would be table talk with de Vere and his brother-in-law. It was essentially unavailable to anyone else.
There's also the matter of the character Polonius. He was the father of Ophelia, whom Hamlet spurned. And it was de Vere's own father-in-law, who many traditional scholars say was the model for Polonius.
Polonius is this kind of busybody, meddlesome spymaster in the Danish court. This is exactly the central relationship of de Vere's life. De Vere was married to a young woman whose father was the Lord Treasurer, spymaster, busybody supreme of Elizabethan England.
The evidence that Edward de Vere wrote Shakespeare is, of course, entirely circumstantial. But there are scores of such connections, and the case is intriguing enough that in 1987, three sitting Supreme Court justices agreed to hear what became a famous moot court debate: Earl of Oxford versus William Shakespeare. In the following videotape, the attorney for Shakespeare expresses skepticism to Justice John Paul Stevens that a nobleman like Oxford would find it beneath him to sign his name to the plays.
The main Oxfordian argument, the one on which my learned friend relied, is that it was a matter of great shame to be revealed as the author of literary works.
For me to at least raise the question whether the Queen, who did a number of things that are difficult to explain, she was a person with certain idiosyncrasies and fond of secrecy, and well, perhaps if the monarch said, I don't want your authorship known, that would be the end of it as far as what De Vere might do.
I would be the last to deny the idiosyncrasies of monarchy.
Back at the Globe Theatre, Charles Beauclerc says that had his ancestor, De Vere, the Earl of Oxford, put his name on the plays, it would have been no laughing matter. The tragedies and comedies contained exposés of some of the court's most powerful, ruthless, and deadly people.
He wouldn't have survived 10 minutes because of the satirical and political content of the plays. He needed to mask that in some way, whether through a pen name or through a pen name and a front man, which is clearly what he used.
Now back to that 1987 moot court. The justices did find for William Shakespeare, but later all three came to doubt their decision. A few years ago, Justice John Paul Stevens told the New York Times that if he had to choose today, quote, I'd say it definitely was Oxford. And Ari, since neither the Earl of Oxford nor the gentleman from Stratford left behind a handwritten or signed copy of any of the works of Shakespeare, this debate could go on forever and a day. But you and I must now take our leave.
Yes, and ask our listeners, as you from crimes would pardoned be, let your indulgence set us free.
Just after midnight, Californians woke up to a new reality.
Now in California, driving while holding a cell phone is against the law.
The state with the most cars and the most highways in the nation is finally going hands-free. The cell phone industry fought it tooth and nail, and California lawmakers spent 6 years trying to pass the new restriction. Now state police say they'll aggressively enforce the new law. Here's NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates.
The warnings have been coming for months. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger held a press conference a few weeks ago to remind Californians that their driving laws were going to change soon.
We know that cell phones are the number one cause of distracted driving accidents. And according to some estimates, getting drivers' hands off the cell phones and onto the steering wheel will save almost 300 lives a year in California.
A lot of people approve. In downtown Culver City, Linda Albrecht tells me why she does.
I believe you should not drive and talk at the same time. When my children call me, I say, I hope you aren't driving. Get off the phone.
Yesterday, Steve Thomas was still holding on to his cell.
I will today probably, but probably not tomorrow.
Thomas has no plans to go hands-free. He says he'll put down his phone and enjoy the silence.
It'll be kind of nice, I think.
There have been television PSAs like the one you just heard, online warnings, and big signs on the highways telling drivers the new law starts immediately in July. Standing near his motorcycle on the patio of the California Highway Patrol office in Culver City, Sergeant Rhett Price says as far as he's concerned, the sooner the law goes into effect, the better.
A day hasn't gone by that I don't see somebody using their cell phone, talking on the phone with one hand, changing lanes without properly looking over their shoulder or checking to the left or to the right, and almost causing a collision. In fact, I've had it happen several times with me.
California's cell held threat is being eliminated, but there are plenty other things that are still legal. For now, you can still drive and dial or even send a text message. As for other possible distractions, there are no laws prohibiting makeup application, shaving, or negotiating a chili burger while driving. Which doesn't mean you can't be cited. California's Safe Speed Law is an amazingly flexible tool that allows officers to cite people whose behind-the-wheel multitasking makes them a danger to themselves and others. Sergeant Rhett Price.
There are just some things that people have to understand they shouldn't be doing while they're driving. We can argue in court why it was unsafe for somebody to be texting or putting on their mascara or eating a sloppy burger at the time that they were driving their vehicle.
For now, the public focus is on hands-free phoning. As the deadline approached, people rushed to comply with the law.
We've been selling tons of these.
Greg Carter is general manager of Costco in Hawthorne, California. The new law is prominently posted here above a 6-foot-high display of hands-free headsets. Carter says this display is considerably smaller now than it was even a few weeks ago.
Early on, there was some confusion that the law was going to start in January, so we did see a spike in sales in late December and early January, but nothing like what we've seen over the past 4 weeks.
The kits Costco carries cost from $40 to $60. That one-time expense may spare drivers the price of a ticket. The first-time citation is $20, but with court costs, that could go up to $76. The next time, it could be as much as $192, and it gets increasingly expensive after that. One group who won't be rushing to buy hands-free kits are drivers under 18. The new law forbids them from driving and talking, period. During his press conference, Governor Schwarzenegger urged parents to be strict and says he's already laid down the law to his teenage daughters.
I told them that if I catch them driving with, cell phones in their hands or making any calls, that the car will be gone and the cell phones will be gone.
Many auto safety experts would applaud that, since some research argues it's not holding the phone, but talking on it that's the biggest danger to drivers of all ages. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News. What can I do? I feel so blue. I've gotta give this message to you. I'm sending you an